Film Spotting SVU is presented by Movies on Demand on Cable, bringing the latest indie movies into your home at the touch of a button.
The English and Japanese language film Kumiko the Treasure Hunter tells the story of a frustrated office lady who abandons her life in search of treasure. Starring Academy Award nominee Rinko Kikuchi as the title character, it is now playing on demand. The romantic dramedy A Little Chaos, starring Kate Winslet and Alan Rickman, premieres on demand on June 26th, the same day it hits theaters.
The latest independent films are ready when you are with Movies on Demand on Cable. The Art House is now in your house.
New York City, this is Film Spotting, streaming video units. I'm Allison Wilmore.
And I am Matt Singer. In this episode, Allison and I will outline our very important plans to write the definitive book on Turkish theater as we discuss last year's Palme d'Or winner at Cannes, Winter Sleep.
Later in the show, we'll bring you cue shots where we recommend some titles you can rent or stream at home right now, all centered on a common theme. Winter Sleep is famously for a fairly little small film, just shy of 200 minutes long. And someone suggested that we do an episode dedicated to other movies with very long runtimes. So you may have noticed this installment is about a month late. We've spent the whole time watching Modern Times Forever, a Danish film depicting, over a runtime of 240 hours, how a Helsinki office building would decay over eons. We actually got two-thirds of the way through, and then I dozed off, and we thought it was only right to start over from the beginning to get the full experience.
Yes.
We weren't actually brave enough to take on this topic. We did not have the endurance for even something maybe a tenth of the length of Modern Times Forever. So instead, we'll be recommending some movies set in hotels inspired by the gorgeous and remote one in which most of Winter Sleep takes place. But first up, it's Opening Break, a segment we do in conjunction with our sponsor, Movies on Demand on Cable, in which we spotlight a few notable films new on demand on cable. Matt, you're up this time. What are our picks?
We've got some new films from some big-name directors available on VOD now, starting with this one called Manglehorn, directed by David Gordon Green. And it's a new film starring Al Pacino, Holly Hunter, Chris Messina, and Harmony Korine. In a performance. He's not the director. He's one of the stars. David Gordon Green is the director here. I'll read you the official plot description. A.J. Manglehorn, that's the Pacino character, I believe, is a reclusive Texas keymaker who spends his days caring for his cat, finding comfort in his work, and lamenting a long-lost love. Enter kind-hearted bank teller Dawn, played by Holly Hunter, whose interest in the eccentric Manglehorn may just be able to draw him out of his shell. I have a hard time imagining Pacino as a guy who has to be drawn out of his shell. His whole persona is the guy who has exploded his shell by screaming.
Dear Claire, loving you is the only thing I haven't done right. You know, you're wearing this very similar dress that Clara used to wear.
Who's Clara?
She was a very special woman in my life. She was really great company.
Allison, I know you've seen this one.
I have seen this one.
Well, I don't know what you... I've seen your tweet about it from the Toronto International Film Festival last year where he played.
Ago. Yes.
It's hard to get a read on how much you enjoyed it. Was it a lot? Was it a little?
It was, I would say, a little. Though
here's what you wrote.
Yeah, remind me.
Well, I guess this is what it looks like to build a movie around Al Pacino being as weird as he wants.
It's true. It's all very true. I would say we spoke about Joe, which was another
yes.
David Gordon Green movie in which he kind of gave a kind of big central role to another actor known for sometimes going a little over the top, Nicolas
yes.
Cage. And I would say that Manglehorn and Joe kind of fit together as a double feature, maybe. Joe is the more coherent one. Manglehorn is an odd movie, and
okay.
It didn't really work for me.
Well, I'm interested in it because, as you said, David Gordon Green, kind of on this, like, he's almost doing, like, the Tarantino thing, where he's
right.
finding these actors who have kind of lost their way and kind of doing these reclamation projects. And we didn't love Joe, but I think it was a fairly successful movie, and it was a really good Nicolas Cage performance, and it did remind you of how great he can be. And Al Pacino is a guy who certainly could use that sort of career resuscitation. He seems to be trying to get it. He's doing a bunch of these smaller independent movies. I guess once you've kind of done Jack and Jill with Adam Sandler and you played yourself,
yes,
and you did a literally like you did a Dunkin' Donuts commercial in the middle of the movie
in which you rhymed your name with Dunkachino.
Yes, Al Pacino and Dunkachino. He sings this. It's
if you haven't seen that,
it's actually kind of an amazing scene.
It's incredible.
Yes, but the rest of the movie maybe not so much. But you know, I think when you get to that point, you go, I got to do something else. You know, and so I am really curious about Manglehorn. I'm looking forward to checking it out. I haven't seen it yet. So that is Manglehorn. It is available now on VOD. Also available now on VOD from another director who I would say is hit or miss, but when he hits, I always really like his work. That's Michael Winterbottom, and his new film is called The Face of an Angel, and it stars Kate Beckinsale, Daniel Brühl, and Cara Delevingne. How do you pronounce her last
Cara
name?
Cara Delevingne, I think.
Thank you.
She's going to be
a big
star.
Yeah, she's in Suicide Squad. That's why I'm glad you could help me out there, because I hadn't heard it pronounced yet, but I know she is an actress on the rise. Let me read you the official description of this one. The Face of an Angel tells the story of a journalist and a filmmaker as they lose themselves in a notorious murder case they are covering based on true events, a riveting account of the controversial case of an American student accused of murder in Italy. And that's the Amanda Knox story, which I have to admit, I don't know a ton about. I didn't really follow that as it was transpiring in the news and the tabloids and such. I'm not sure how familiar you are with it, Allison. Have you seen this movie?
I have not seen this movie. It was a murder case, and there was a lot of, I think, attention to because it was like pretty college students, and I didn't follow the details too much, other than that I think that the person who was kind of held up as the biggest suspect turned out to be cleared.
Spoiler alert. Now I want to see the movie.
Movie's ruined.
What are you doing?
I thought the whole point of the movie was media, whatever.
Maybe.
So there you
go. I don't know. I haven't seen it, but I'm
curious.
Just read
the description. I haven't either.
That's true. I'm curious. You know, like I said, Michael Winterbottom, he makes a lot of movies, and a lot of them, frankly, aren't that great. But like I said, when he makes something that's good, I really tend to respond strongly to it. You know, the Trip movies are some of my favorite movies of the last couple of years. So I'm hoping to enjoy this one as well. That's The Face of an Angel. And that's available now on VOD. And finally, available on VOD on June 26th, a movie I'm very confident I will enjoy. It is called Big Game. Do you know what Big Game is, Allison?
I do.
This is the film in which Samuel Jackson stars as
the President of the United States.
That's right. And I will read you the plot description. When Air Force One is shot down by terrorists, leaving the President of the United States stranded in the wilderness, there is only one person who can save him. A 13-year-old boy called Askari. So, yeah, it's kind of like it's like Air Force One meets
The Most Dangerous Game,
meets maybe or The Gray or something. Yeah,
yeah.
Sounds really crazy and weird and silly, but and has gotten some good response. People who have seen it told me it's a lot of fun. And just the idea of Samuel Jackson having yet again more problems with a plane. He does not have good luck with planes. If you see Samuel Jackson on a plane, if you're flying to L.A. or from L.A. somewhere and he's on the plane, I would recommend rebooking the flight. Doesn't have a lot of luck with planes, but just the idea that of him as the president shot down and needs a 13-year-old boy to help him survive. I hope he spends the whole movie cursing out the small child. There's really nothing I want more than to hear him screaming obscenities at a 13-year-old boy. That sounds tremendous to me. So that is Big Game, and that will be available on VOD starting on June 26th.
Peki diyelim gittin. Nereye gideceksin?
Vallahi nereye olursa oraya gideceğim Aydın, bilmiyorum. İstanbul'a gideceğim. Ne olmuş yani, bir iş bulur çalışırım. Allah Allah.
Ay Nihal. Ah Nihal, ah iki gözüm ya.
Every episode on Film Spotting SVU, we let you vote on the film or sometimes the television show that we will review in the next installment. And this time around, your choices were the New Zealand vampire mockumentary, What We Do in the Shadows, the Jimi Hendrix biopic, Jimmy, All Is By My Side, and Nuri Bilge Ceylan's Winter Sleep. And while What We Do in the Shadows had a big lead for most of the week voting was open, Winter Sleep made a sudden and, frankly, suspicious leap ahead in the last few hours of the polls. You know, there might be a lot of secret Neri Bilge Ceylan fans out there. I mean, he certainly has a great, you know, reputation on the international festival circuit. But I feel prompted to make one of our periodic reminders that you really shouldn't game the polls. It's not too hard to rig them, but it goes against the spirit of opening the subject of each episode up to a vote in the first place. So with that said, Winter Sleep is our review.
I did watch What We Do in the Shadows, and I did enjoy it very much.
Okay, I have not seen it yet, you know, but I am
looking
forward to it.
Very funny, very good.
Well, Winter Sleep is the seventh film from Turkish filmmaker Neri Bilge Ceylan, and his first to win the Palme d'Or, the biggest prize at the Cannes Film Festival, though he's won several other prizes at the festival previously. Like his last film, Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, Winter Sleep is set in Anatolia, in a beautiful, mountainous, historical region where a man named Aydin, who's played by Haluk Bilginer, who you can also see in Rosewater and The Reluctant Fundamentalist, he's actually been acting in some international projects as well, owns a hotel. Aydin's wealthy, having inherited the land and the hotel from his father, though he goes back and forth on admitting to being well off. Sometimes he uses it as leverage. Some other times he talks about growing up with very little and having worked like a dog. He's a former actor who now spends his time preparing to write a history of Turkish theater. Otherwise, he likes to pen judgmental columns in a local paper. And also, he likes to deftly needle his divorced sister, Nisia, and his estranged younger wife, Nihal, both of whom live with him. Winter Sleep is more a series of encounters in many ways than a story. There's the encounter that Aydin has with the son of one of his tenants, who's angry about how his family was humiliated when Aydin sent a debt collector when they couldn't pay the rent. There are the conversations that Nisia and Nihal, neither of whom can really quite bring themselves to leave despite being pretty unhappy, have with one another and with Aydin. There's the encounter Aydin has with his old friend Suavi and a young teacher named Levent over drinks. And all the while, snow comes down outside, sealing these people in together for better or worse. Matt, you were not a fan of Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, though I liked it quite a bit. Winter Sleep is even longer, even more deliberate, and less interested in action. Did you find it similarly frustrating?
Yes. Yes, I did. I did not particularly love this film. And I can appreciate a lot of the craft involved. And it's a beautiful looking movie. His movies always are gorgeous. But there's sort of even less of that beautiful natural scenery to enjoy than something like Once Upon a Time in Anatolia, where, as you're saying, a lot of this movie is sort of claustrophobic. It's set in this hotel, which is kind of this amazing, beautiful structure. It's like cut out of the rocks of this mountain. It's this incredible place. It looks like it would be an amazing place to visit, but you don't get to really admire it that much. It's a lot of just people sitting in like studies or little rooms and just having these endless arguments, semantic arguments, moral arguments, ethical arguments. And I can appreciate a lot of the craft involved. I liked certain things about it. I thought the lead actor who you highlighted, I thought gave a fabulous performance. Yeah, I thought he was very effective. In a way, he's almost so good, he kind of exposes one of the problems I had with the movie, which was that I felt that the screenplay was very on the nose in terms of laying out all of the problems with this character, with this man, what his issues are, why he is not as virtuous as he appears to be. But the performance is so perfect, you don't really need to be told. And I felt like we were really getting told over and over again. There's one very important scene between him and his wife where it's actually kind of like a series of scenes. It's almost like an hour of the movie where they're sort of, we see that they have this tension. It's not a very loving relationship. She kind of wants to leave. She can't really leave. She doesn't, you know, he's the one with all the money and she's so frustrated with him and with good reason. And the tension is rising and rising, and it builds to the scene where she kind of lays out exactly what's wrong with him. Cause he asks her, he's like, what am I guilty of? And he needles her until she tells him. And she explains it in like literally like a 500 word essay almost monologue that delineates every single flaw that this character has that we've already established, I think, through kind of more subtle actions and less pointed commentary. And I just felt like scenes like that really brought the movie down, frankly. I think that there is a very fascinating character at the center of this movie, but I did feel like it is this epic 3-hour, 15-minute movie that doesn't have sort of epic insights into its hero or protagonist that I didn't really feel like it earned all that length. And we're not necessarily people who hate long movies, who say movies should be shorter, no movie should be more than 90 minutes. I think that's bunk. But in this case, I did feel like this movie did not need to be 3 hours and 15 minutes.
Did you watch it in one sitting?
I tried to, and I failed. I will be honest and say that at a certain point, I got in that middle hour when they're just sitting in rooms having literally like scenes go on for 15 or 20 minutes while they are just discussing, well, that's not what I meant. Well, actually, this is what you're doing. Well, maybe this is how we should act towards evil people. That I started to doze off, and I was like, I got to stop, and I picked it up the next night because I couldn't. There was a certain narcoleptic effect that the middle of this movie had on me.
See, I didn't find it. I didn't try to watch it in one sitting either, but I didn't find it grueling at all.
Really?
It went fairly easily for me.
Wow.
And I liked it quite a bit. I think I understand your point about the fact that people eventually come to just tell Aiden to his face like his problems. But I think that one of the things the movie does very well is to show how he has developed this like rhetorical endurance where it is impossible to pin him down to ever make him admit or confess his problems, right?
Right.
Like even in that scene with his wife that you spoke of, he like badgers her into saying, like telling him exactly what's wrong, and then basically does a point by point refutation of her problems with him, as if you can resolve a relationship that way, you know, of being like, here's why that's incorrect. Like, here's why the fact that you dislike me is incorrect.
Right.
And like, I thought that it was such a kind of well-written sort of terribleness, you know, that he like that. And it was so kind of coherent throughout in the ways he interacts with everyone that even in that scene, which is this like very kind of embittered, like difficult scene where she says at multiple points, I'm too tired to respond to you. Like, I can't. I give up. Like,
and I understood how she felt. Trust me.
But like that he needs to keep poking at it. That he even, you know, at the end of the movie admits, not out loud, but admits that he, this thing that kind of is clear throughout, which is that he loves her and wants to keep her, but that the ways he shows it are by basically continually inserting himself into her space, but then he can't help but prod at her as well.
Right.
Like, the only way that he wants to be around her, but the only way he can interact with her is basically by like infuriating her. And that's just the way he interacts with everyone, right?
I agree with you. He is a fascinating character, and I think the performance by Alec Bilginer is tremendous. He is fantastic. He is so incredibly punchable. He's just, like, by a certain point, you just want to smack the guy in his smug face. And that's by design. He is fantastic as this sort of character I don't think you see a lot in movies, which is, I would describe him as, like, sort of a bad guy who thinks he's a good guy.
Yeah.
Right? That he, like you said, he has all this wealth, and he believes that his success, whether earned or not, it's, as you said, he kind of waffles on exactly where that success came from. That success, however he got it, gives him this sort of moral authority to judge people who are less successful than he is, which is someone you meet in life. Like, it is a type that I think we have all met.
I think it's like, in that way, it's a kind of like almost too good portrait of like a certain type of wealth, a certain type of wealthy person, right?
Right.
Like that. The inability to put together, or like this idea that you came by wealth that has no kind of bearing on you as a person, that it doesn't mean that you are a better person, that you, especially in this case in which he inherited it, and yet he has no problem seeing it as a sign of his superiority, right? Like he is able to keep all of these ideas that are kind of seemingly contradictory in his head. And while seeing himself as this intellectual, you know, at another point where his sister points out, like, you, or where his wife points out, you hate religion, but you hate people who aren't religious. You hate old tradition, but you also hate people who
he hates everyone.
Tradition.
Right. He judges everyone. It is a fascinating character. I feel like it is a really great portrait of a type of person that we don't see in movies a lot, but is 100% cut from real life that we can all think of. I just felt like I got it at a certain point, and that the way that the movie approached this character kind of diluted that point. That the insights into that character didn't match the, like, extremity of these conversations. And, like, I guess maybe the point of some of those conversations, like I was saying, like, he's so punchable, like, that you are kind of supposed to be driven to almost, like, the brink of insanity by this guy's delusions, right? That, and his refusal, as you said, to, like, ever concede a point. He can't do it. And you are able to kind of relate to these women in his life who want to leave but can't, because we're trapped in here with him for 3 hours and 15 minutes. But I kind of felt like I could have still felt pretty trapped for if it had been 2 hours and 40 minutes. You know what I mean? Like that there's a certain point where you pass a threshold of where it just becomes kind of excessive, and I'm not really, you know, there's like the law of diminishing returns. Like at a certain point, I just become actually frustrated. I can't get any more frustrated where I, like, relatable frustration, where I get, oh, I see what you're saying here. I get the point. I feel where these women are coming from. I understand this character. I really felt like at a certain point, I got the character, but the movie continued, and I didn't feel like there was a lot more to get there.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, this is like not a point that we can really debate.
No, it's
because
it's subjective. Yeah.
But like, it really didn't feel like stretched out, or in like Anatolia felt longer. Once Upon a Time in Anatolia felt longer to me.
Okay. See, I don't remember. I couldn't tell you off the top of my head the runtime of that film. I would have said they both felt about the same to me. They're long movies.
Yeah. I don't know. I really like. The way that also he can be so terrible, but it's a kind of like persistent, small scale terrible that just builds. I think you kind of needed that. You know, he's not always a monster. Like there are times where he seems like a very normal, reasonable person.
Right. And when he's introduced, we get that sense. But then you see slowly. I agree with you that it's certainly a deliberate tactic, and the way, you know, that we see little by little, the little accumulations of things, the way he never can make himself tea or coffee or whatever. He always has to ask someone to get something for him. He can't do anything himself. He has these little, you know, like he treats his wife like a servant. He has actual, like,
workers. There's a nice bit in one scene where he goes to the train station and it's snowy.
Right.
And his, like, assistant is carrying all of his baggage and, like, falls over.
Right. And also has to go talk to the guy, the clerk, to find out when the train is coming. He can't do anything himself. He is completely the opposite of self-sufficient. He was completely dependent on these people that, you know, and that you at first you don't really make something of it, but that's the kind of thing that accumulates, or the way that, you know, he's able to kind of isolate himself from, because he is like a landowner or a landlord, and using these employees, he's able to kind of isolate himself from the dirty, kind of unseemly part of that, which is evicting people or taking their stuff when they don't pay their bills. And he gets to kind of have a sort of willful ignorance about all that. And again, I found all of that stuff worked. And really, you know, slowly building and drawing that stuff out, that was great. But again, I just reached sort of my tolerance, I think, was reached. And after that fact, I just sort of hit like a kind of a toxic level where I was like, I just felt like I got it. And I didn't need any more. And I didn't feel like I've already said, that there was a lot more to it. Other than there was that scene at the end, that's that important scene with the wife and those tenants that are part of the beginning of the movie and sort of set what story that there is here, kind of set it off, and she goes to meet with them. And I thought that was a very interesting and kind of a suspenseful scene. But I did feel like there wasn't really much more in terms of drama that was going on here besides that one scene.
Yeah, this is based on a Chekhov short story, we should say also, which is, you know, short
It doesn't
stories.
Feel like a short story, though,
right? Well, I mean, I think
in film form,
right? But it also speaks to like how much of the actual plot, you know, is used. It's a short story's worth of plot,
right?
Over that, but yeah, I love that last scene, and I think it also provided a little complexity in terms of this, in terms of the idea of like Aiden as this, this kind of tyrannical but oblivious like lord of the area.
Yeah.
And then the people who are just under his heel, mm-hmm. that you have a character who is also terrible, like, you know, responds
absolutely.
By being terrible. Like, it just because you're oppressed doesn't mean you can also not, you know, not lash out in your own way.
Right.
Even if it's not in the interests of those you love.
And I did also think that the very last scene, which we shouldn't spoil, I guess.
It's hard to spoil this
well,
movie.
But just, I didn't, well, I was like, how do you interpret that final voiceover? Like, what exactly is it? Is it an internal monologue? Is it a letter he writes to her? Is it a conversation that they had? Like, we don't necessarily know exactly the sort of context of what he's saying, which could have a huge implication on that character moving forward, whether he's grown or whether he is sort of kind of in his own delusional, going deeper into his sort of delusional world. And I think we could debate that. And I think that I also found that to be a very interesting, effective sort of final sequence. I felt the movie kind of really rebounded in that last kind of 20-30 minutes,
yeah.
with those final couple of scenes. It really was that middle chunk that I really had a problem with. Yeah.
I see. I feel like you have to read that last monologue as an internal one just because it also shows him as being more self-aware. I think throughout the movie, you wonder, there's this like willful obliviousness.
Mm-hmm.
As you said, he shelters himself with the people who work for him.
Right.
So that he can like say to someone that he's on the verge of evicting, like, I didn't even know. You know, the lawyers do this automatically.
Right, plausible
like,
deniability.
Right. You know, and then the way he treats his wife, the way he treats his sister, the way he treats this, like, the school teacher who he's basically jealous of, he's jealous of and has his eye on and therefore bullies.
Yes.
And I think the idea in that, the kind of idea in the end that's offered that he is aware of what, he is at least a little aware of himself, I think kind of it really makes the movie, you
mm-hmm.
know, that he's not just, that there is like self-loathing there as well, but also that it doesn't mean that you can change.
Right. And it's I thought it was just interesting to contemplate whether that realization is shared with anyone or whether it's being kept to himself. And I think I feel like the movie offers a fairly, you know, sort of strong suggestion of what the movie thinks, but I think it's enough open to debate that you could have an interesting conversation just about that moment. But yeah, I don't know. I I do think there's a lot of craft involved. Clearly, there's incredibly talented people here, you know, brilliant people making a movie. I have a hard time like recommending this movie to someone, especially to watch at home. I think this is the kind of movie it can be a good movie in a movie theater, but you really have to block out the world if you're going to watch this movie on streaming. You know, it is not an easy film to watch at home, even in multiple sittings, I think, you know, because I think that the part of it is that accumulation of the details, the little itty bitty details of this guy that we slowly get drawn out. So honestly, if I was going to recommend it to someone, I would kind of say hope that it gets revived in a movie theater near you at some point, and that's the way to see it. I don't know that I would encourage someone to watch it on Netflix, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I didn't have as much of a problem as I mentioned, but I do think, I mean, if it's in a movie theater, I would certainly recommend it along with all of his films just because they are really just beautifully shot. Like,
yes.
You know, you mentioned this one is not maybe filled with as many wow moments, but I think there are a few filmmakers who I think are able to do as much with like light sources and dark rooms, you know?
Yes.
Like, there are a few shots in this particularly. I think the one in which the conversation takes place with the wife.
Yes.
And the
brother. The lighting in that scene is incredible.
It's exquisite. Yeah.
Yes.
And, you know.
No, and maybe that's part of my problem is that he is such a great visual filmmaker and that there doesn't seem like there's a ton of that sort of visual filmmaking going on. You know, there's a few moments. There's the one moment that really struck me was there's a tourist at the hotel who is leaving, and they have a conversation when he's like saying, which is kind of funny because like the tourists always, they all can't seem to can't wait to leave because.
Right. And he's also very friendly with them in a way he is with no one else in the movie.
He is, but it's almost like you get that, you're kind of jealous of those characters because they can leave and you can't, and these other people are sort of trapped and miserable. But, you know, the character says, we're leaving, you know, we have to go in the morning, we're checking out. And he says, oh, you know, so sad that you're leaving. You have to go so soon. He seems genuinely kind of bummed out when people leave. And then there's a cut to him sitting in a graveyard, like a snowy graveyard. And just the most beautiful shot. But and it conveys so much about, like, that when these people leave, that this loss that he feels, it's there's no words. There's no conversation there. And it conveys so much. And those are the sort of moments that I felt were kind of in short supply in this movie, whereas it was a lot more of 20, 25-minute dialogue discussions.
I don't know. I mean, there are other ones. Like, there's a scene where he looks at, like, the village, you know, towards the end.
Yeah.
He gets out of the car.
Yeah.
And it looks like this, like, snow globe. Like, it's mm-hmm. so picturesque.
Yeah.
And he's there on the outside. And it's not, you know, like, it's not a place that needs him.
Right.
You know,
and again, that's another moment at the end of the movie, which was the part that I thought was, you know, it did recover nicely and had some nice moments in the ending. It was really that middle section that I would have taken an Avid to, or an old Moviola to, or what
razor,
have you.
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. Trimmed a little bit out of there, or a lot.
All right. Well, that's Winter Sleep. I like it a little more than that. But either way, it's one that you know, have to gird yourself for. It is now streaming on Netflix.
I could go on talking, or I could stop, ring out each memory till I get every drop. Sift through the details of the others involved. The true crime would be thinking it's just one person's fault. Like an honest signature on a fake ID. Like the guilty conscience with the innocent plea. You can just ignore it, put it out of mind. But ain't it funny how the past won't ever let something lie? Let's make a list of all the things the world has put you through. Let's raise a glass to all the people you're not speaking to. I don't know what else you wanted me to say to you. Things happen, that's all they ever do.
All right, in honor of Winter Sleep, let's recommend some more hotel movies, movies set in hotels or movies where hotels play very crucial, important roles. Allison, do you have anything you want to say before we get to our picks?
Well, I think the one thing that a lot of these movies speak to, that, like, just looking over, like, some of the most famous hotel films, right? Like The Shining, or like Lost in Translation, or, you know, or the idea that you are captive somewhere, basically, that there's an innate claustrophobia to this, and it kind of challenges you to use space in a certain way, for the movie to use space in a certain way, and you kind of build on what you get when you have a group of characters who are together, and I like that. I like the kind of limits that imposes. I think it can lead to some interesting things. Or some weird things, like Four Rooms, which you can stream on Netflix.
If you want to.
If you want to.
We're not advising you do that. We take no responsibility if you choose to watch Four Rooms. But you can if you want to. Yeah, that's a great point. I don't have a ton more to say. I think we can just discuss it when we get to our picks.
All right.
I would say as much as I was critical of Winter Sleep, I would love to go to that hotel.
Yeah,
right?
That hotel looked fantastic.
Amazing.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Oh, I will say it's not presented as a hotel in the movie, but the Ex Machina is set in an actual hotel in Scandinavia.
Yes, that is true.
And that is one place I would love to visit.
But how much of that place is actually, like, the hotel? Is the whole thing a hotel?
I think a lot. The whole thing is
including
a hotel.
Like the underground area that's, like, sort of the,
I imagine that's the hallway, like a hallway.
That's actually a hallway in that hotel.
I think so.
Wow.
And yeah, it looks pretty good. I would go there.
Yes.
All right. You want to go first?
Sure. I'll go first. I it's funny because I enjoy being in hotels generally, but my first pick is a horror movie. There's a lot of horror movies set at hotels. You already mentioned The Shining. This is a horror movie set at a hotel as well. It is called Vacancy. It is from 2007. It is directed by a gentleman named Nimrod Antal. and it is currently available for rent on various websites. And people often talk about horror movies that they either like or maybe they're too afraid to watch because they delve into something they're actually afraid of. Like, my wife has never seen The Birds because she's actually kind of afraid of birds, and that would be, you know, too horrifying to consider. But one of the scariest things for me is when a movie almost, like, gives you a fear. It gives you a phobia you didn't actually know you had before. And I can't say I was ever really afraid of, like, remote hotels, even after seeing something like Psycho, which is another very scary movie set in and around a hotel. But I saw Vacancy, and I have to say, I was like, I'm going to do everything in my power for the rest of my life to avoid going anywhere near a place like this isolated rural motel. Kate Beckinsale and Luke Wilson star in the film. They're a couple. They're driving out in the middle of nowhere. They get lost. Their car breaks down. Their phone goes dead. They wind up at the motel from hell, basically. Their room features a bunch of videotapes. When they put them in, they turn out to be snuff films. That's strike one. Then strike two turns out that when they realize that the snuff films were actually recorded in the room they're staying at, which is really horrifying and disturbing. That, I guess that's strike two. And then strike three would be when the murderers start trying to kill them. That's it. This place, it's not going to get a good review on TripAdvisor. Let's put it that way. They are chased around, menaced by these masked psychopaths for the rest of the movie. And I look, it's fairly formulaic stuff. It is a slasher movie. It is people trapped in an isolated place. And what elevates it, what makes it good, is the precision with which it's done by this guy, Nimrod Antal, this Hungarian-American filmmaker. He made this movie Control with a K and two L's, wasn't that the name also of the
Anton Corbijn?
Yeah. Joy Division movie. This is not that movie. This is Control with a K and two L's, about a ticket inspector in the Budapest Metro. After that, he made Vacancy, and then he made my favorite of his movies, which is called Armored. Did you ever see Armored?
I did not, but I think you've talked to me about
just
it.
Just this wonderful little like B heist movie about a heist gone bad. Basically reminds me of something like Phil Carlson would have made 50 years ago. Just a wonderful B movie. And I think that's what Nimrod Antal kind of does well, at least what I've been impressed by so far in his movies, is just that kind of effective manipulation of an audience. He has a good sense of what scares an audience or just what gives someone in the audience a visceral reaction, you know, whether it's suspense or excitement or terror. And Vacancy did what not a lot of movies do, is it legitimately scared me. And not just the movie itself, but just it really made me contemplate, because, you know, We all drive. I do a lot of driving. We drive back and forth, my wife and I, to visit her family. It's like, God forbid something happened on the road. It's like it really made you pause. It made me pause. And I would probably rather sleep in my car than ever check into a motel like the one in this movie. And so I give it a lot of credit for really terrifying me in that way. And it is, again, not a movie that sort of busts its formula or, you know, elevates its formula to high art, but just a very effective horror movie. If you're in the mood for that sort of thing, I think it does what it sets out to do perfectly well. That is Vacancy, and that is available right now to rent.
All right. My first pick is maybe the opposite of a remote roadside motel. It is Death in Venice, which is available for rent and is the 1971 film directed by Luchino Visconti and based on the Thomas Mann novella Death in Venice, starring Dirk Bogarde as Gustav von Aschenbach, a composer who travels to Venice to rest for health reasons, the way people used to. Doesn't that sound excellent? I need to go.
I could use one of those.
Yes, I need to go take the waters somewhere. For the season.
God, that does sound good.
Sounds excellent, right? Yeah. It also says Bjorn Andersen as the beautiful Polish boy with whom Gustav falls in love. When this film came out, it was criticized for being maybe too literal and too clumsy an adaptation of Mann, who's kind of not a very operatic writer, and Visconti is very much an operatic filmmaker. And certainly there are some things that I think don't work in this, particularly the flashbacks into Gustav's life, including a look at his kind of his troubled marriage and a weird scene in which he visits a brothel. But all of the present day things are really incredibly sumptuous. And I think that if maybe it's not a great adaptation of the novella, it is still a really kind of like moving, soaring movie unto itself. It's really just the story of a man who's tried to kind of intellectualize and avoid and repress strong emotions all of his life. And then he becomes caught up in this doomed but very sincere and totally kind of impulsive love with this figure who really may not know he ever exists. He like idolizes this boy from afar, and he gets to represent, you know, youth and beauty and the ineffable and all of these things that he's yearning for. And he becomes a little ridiculous in his yearning for this boy. But the movie is like filled with these long shots in which you kind of see the camera pans across the room in the resorts before seeing this boy like in the corner or arriving at where Gustav is. And it's where you see you really get to take in the setting. And Matt, the setting here is just amazing. Like, it is a hotel on the Lido in Venice where it's just filled with wealthy guests who, you know, dine every night in like in the dining room and then go out in the day to these like the beach that's filled with little like private huts where people will sit in the shade or run around in their vintage bathing suits. It's really like the detail that goes into this movie and the amount of like people who are in it just filling the background is really incredible. Like the snippets of conversation in various languages that kind of come through, the way in which it summons this world, this like very sumptuous world of holidaymakers having a good time in the summer. And then on the outside, you have this slowly realize that there is this cholera epidemic in the city of Venice that no one has told the tourists about because they're afraid they'll leave and the city is so dependent on tourists. So
it's Jaws.
It's not quite Jaws, no, because Jaws, at least you had to go in the water. You could have just stayed out.
All right, fair point.
You know,
fair point.
But there are people like who are dying, and every time Gustav goes into the city proper, it's like empty, more and more empty, and there'll be like people like passing out in the train station, and people disinfecting things, and he ignores it because he wants to stay and kind of bask in this glory of this boy who's, you know, looks like the face of an angel. To quote that movie title. And I think that the movie really creates a world in which this hotel is this dangerous, like kind of decadent bubble from which the main character can't go away. And Dirk Bogarde really goes for it in this role, a role that requires him to look kind of poignant and silly at the same time, particularly towards the end. It's very moving and gorgeous. So that is Death in Venice, and it is available for rent.
That is a movie I haven't seen. I am a Visconti fan, but not an expert. You know, the movies of his that I've seen, I've really liked, but I have to see more of them. And that is one I haven't seen, but you convinced me that it is worth checking out. I don't know when I'll have the chance to, but I definitely need to make some time to see that one. My next pick is currently available on Netflix, and it is called Dirty Pretty Things from 2002, directed by Stephen Frears. And one of the interesting things about hotels in general, not just in movies, is sort of the almost invisible kind of ecosystems within them that, as a guest, you are barely kind of privy to. The employees, the people that work there every day doing these, you know, odd jobs to keep things clean or to answer the phone. You know, the people that you're sort of not even really meant to think about while you're there because you're supposed to be on vacation or whatever. And what's great about Dirty Pretty Things is that it uses that invisible ecosystem as almost like an allegory for this whole invisible immigrant class in London. All of these people that do all these kind of horrible, crappy jobs that, you know, the citizens don't want to do. I think it was what basically was his, you know, like sort of his breakout role, the role that really made him a star or really brought him to international attention. It stars Chiwetel Ejiofor as Okwe, this Nigerian immigrant. He's working two jobs. He's a cab driver by day. He's a clerk at a hotel's front desk by night. But in Nigeria, he was a doctor. And so he is kind of uniquely qualified to investigate this kind of mystery that he kind of stumbles into the middle of when he answers the phone, or I guess someone comes up to the front desk and tells him that you have to clean up this room, and he goes into the room and he finds this, the toilet is overflowing, and in a kind of a very nightmarish sequence, after what's been a pretty, I hate using the word gritty to describe any movie these days,
but
it's a very,
yeah.
a very sort of naturalistic kind of slice of life portrait of this guy, this immigrant in London. He goes into this room. It almost is kind of like The Shining now that I'm thinking about it. And he kind of takes a, he takes a wire hanger and jams it into the toilet and pulls out a heart. He finds a human heart in the toilet, and finding this thing kind of sets him off to uncover the secret of how it got there, and he finds this whole sort of conspiracy base. Basically, this hotel is not going to get a good TripAdvisor review either, is what I'm realizing, Allison. And I actually had never seen this movie before. I watched it earlier today, and I really, really liked it. And what's great about it is it works well as a mystery, as a thriller about this sort of world that Okwe finds in the midst of this hotel, sort of, you know, beneath his eyes that was going on. But it also works very well, or maybe even better, as this portrait of immigrants, of these people who are struggling to survive. You know, Okwe, this really, he's just a really good guy who is forced by bad circumstances, unfortunate circumstances, to do these unsavory or sometimes even these illegal things to get by. And you also have Audrey Tautou from Amelie. She's his friend, this other immigrant. She's from Turkey. She's working as a maid. And she's being pursued by these immigrant officials from the government because they're suspicious that maybe she is working, her visa or whatever is doesn't allow her to work. But it's like, how is she supposed to survive if she can't legally work? It's, you know, and they're chasing after her, and the desperation of all of that, I think, ties in a sort of literal and also metaphorical way into what Okwe finds, which I'm trying not to spoil sort of the explanation for the heart, which I guess is kind of obvious given what it is. But I'm if you haven't seen it, I didn't actually know really what was going to happen. So I really enjoy the setting of the movie, this London hotel, which kind of has a, you know, it's certainly not a Venetian palace, but it has sort of a faux kind of glitzy vibe to it. But you really see kind of the seediness, or just the sort of the day-to-day grind that is required to keep that kind of veneer of wealth or cleanliness, that there are these crummy jobs that are involved in that. And I really enjoyed it, and I hadn't seen it, and I was glad that I ended up going, you know, I've never seen Dirty Pretty Things, and it says here it's set in a hotel, and it was a really interesting movie. While it would be an incredibly long double feature, it actually would make an interesting double feature with Winter Sleep. So that's Dirty Pretty Things, and that is available now on Netflix.
It's a good movie. I haven't seen that since it was in theaters. I think I saw it in theaters.
I never saw it. And Chiwetel Ejiofor is fantastic, too. Yeah. And you can see immediately, like, within those first 15 very naturalistic minutes, you immediately go, oh, yeah, this guy was a huge star. It's no wonder that this was his breakout role. He's fantastic. He's great.
Yeah. All right. Well, my next pick is it's one that I've mentioned before, but wanted to go into in a bit more detail. It is Force Majeure, which is currently streaming on Netflix, the recent film from Ruben Östlund, which is set at a ski resort in the Swiss Alps, set entirely there, and for reasons that play out really well. This is a film about a Swedish family who's staying at this resort. There's Tomas and his wife Ebba, and then they have two children. The pivotal scene that takes place very early on is one in which they're eating outside, getting lunch. It's a nice day. They're on the mountain, and then there's an avalanche, and it starts coming down the hill. This, like many of the shots in the movie, is a kind of fixed shot that just lets the action unfold within it. And the snow starts coming down the hill, and it gathers force, and Tomas, having said, like, oh, it's a controlled avalanche, you know, it's really neat how they do this. They do this all the time. They all start to get panicky as it gets closer and closer. And as it looks like it's actually going to maybe hit the cafe, he runs away, maybe kind of pushing his children and wife aside as he does it. And she is left with the children huddling as like there's kind of like debris from the snow in the air. And then it turns out it was actually a controlled avalanche and everything's okay. And everyone goes back to eating lunch and he kind of comes back and tries to pretend that nothing has happened and that he did not just abandon his family when he thought his life was in danger. And the way that the movie uses the absurdity of skiing and also of being on vacation works out so well because it is so like pitilessly funny and like and claustrophobic, you know, that things like the fact that the family is all sleeping in one big bed in this hotel room suddenly become like unbearable when you have this like giant fight that people are trying, like these two characters are trying to have. Or in the case of Tomas, he tries to pretend it never happened for a long time, including when his wife calls him out about it in conversation with other people. He says, you know, we remember it differently and things like that.
I'm just hearing you describe it. I am thinking of Winter Sleep.
Yes,
and
exactly.
Those two characters, actually, those lead characters, there's a certain amount of male delusion there that fits quite nicely together, actually.
Very good points. And yes, and then you have this long-suffering wife who's...
Yeah, the long-suffering wife who just exasperated beyond belief, and rightfully so.
Yeah.
Men are horrible is basically what we're saying. And I'm sorry on behalf of, you know, all the members of my gender.
But there is some really, just even the way it continually cuts to like the ongoing business of the resort, like the snow, you know, like the snow getting sprayed in the morning, the outside, all the tiny little windows at night. And then the way that things like an important fight that they're having, they go outside to have it in the hallway because their kids are inside. And there's like a cleaning guy just standing there and he refuses to move away.
Smoking a cigarette on the balcony above, just staring at them,
just staring
watching
at
them.
Yeah. And I think like this, there's a real dry sense of humor that this movie gets from just shots of the weirdness of skiing, like the long takes of them like on a conveyor belt, like going out or coming back to the resort, or of someone like on a ski tow getting pulled all the way up the hill. Or in one of the funnier scenes when Ebba is taking us on a ski lift with a stranger and just the way that you're just trapped in with a stranger, like the claustrophobia of this like experience of the outdoors, you know, this like, it's funny that it's a controlled avalanche that kind of sets this off. Like all of this is like immaculately controlled and kind of choreographed bits of like sport. Right. And that the ways in which it's so controlled suddenly become terrible when these characters are like caught in this giant conflict. It's one of those rare films in which, a lot of the kind of humor and the tension comes from framing in a way that's really deftly done. And there, you know, some particularly good performances, particularly the actor who plays Tomas, who allows his character to be pathetic and to be humiliated and also have a really funny kind of moment of redemption. That's not very earned, but
I would put redemption in air quotes, frankly.
He's seizing it as a moment of redemption, whether anyone agrees or not. But I really like this movie, and the really like the intense deadpan with which it treats its characters and with it's kind of very minor but like seismic conflicts in this marriage is well done and just comes out visually in ways that are really, I think, kind of innovative and very witty. So it's one that I've recommended before and I will recommend again, especially in the context of films that use their resort or hotel setting well, because
yes.
This one certainly does. It's Force Majeure and it is streaming on Netflix.
One of my favorites from last year. Definitely would second that recommendation. All right, now it's time for I know Allison's favorite segment on the show, which is Allison. It's called Allison. What's the name of the segment, Allison? Just shaking her head at me. You can't see it, but she's not happy. You're going to have to learn the name of it sometime. How long is this going to go on? You're just going to...
I'm content to let you carry me as far as you're willing to do it.
All right. Well, I'll give you this time, but then I expect next time in 2 weeks, you're going to come back here. You're going to know that it's called Singer and Wilmore's Completely Concise and Totally Succinct New Release Roundup. You're going to know it, right?
Yep. Sure. Totally. Totally.
I'm really doubting your commitment to Sparkle Motion here. Well, we haven't seen the movies that are coming out this week at this point. We haven't seen Ted 2, which I'm assuming is a masterpiece. We haven't seen Max, which is about a dog with PTSD.
It's a weird week in the for summer movies.
Would you rather watch the foul-mouthed, anthropomorphized teddy bear or the anthropomorphized dog with PTSD? Yeah. You choose, America. It's up to you. So we haven't seen either of those yet. The press screenings are coming up this week as we're recording this. But we have seen last week's big movie, which we both really liked, and so we should at least discuss for a brief minute, encourage people to see it. It is Inside Out, and it is the new film from Pixar and Pete Docter, the filmmaker behind Monsters, Inc. and Up. Is he the best Pixar filmmaker with that resume, Allison?
I mean, that's a pretty good resume.
Yeah.
Yeah. And this movie, after, it's been like a few okay movies in a row for Pixar, this is really a return to form and also a reminder of just how good they are at introducing these kind of very unlikely and sometimes kind of like complicated concepts. Like this movie, beyond having, replicating maybe the concept of Herman's Head, the canceled sitcom, but it also it presents this like realizing of kind of like child psychology and human psychology, and then uses it for this adventure that like is like child appropriate, but also will totally captivate adults and probably make them sob.
Made me sob. It's a sad movie, but that is why it is worth seeing. And that is the point of it too, is that sadness is okay.
Yeah.
We are trained by many Hollywood films that sadness is not okay, that we must just be happy, happy, happy all the time. But what is so amazing about Inside Out, which is effective as a movie about childhood and growing up and maturing and emotions, it also works as a movie about movie making, which is that you can't just be happy all the time. You can't just have just vapid escapist entertainment all the time. You need a little sadness in there. You need to mix that in there as well. And I think it's an amazing movie. It is. I made me cry quite a bit. And I just think it's brilliant, and the whole construction of it. Yeah, you can say, oh, it's Herman's Head is the exact same premise, but it does so much more with that premise than Herman's Head did.
I've actually never seen Herman's Head.
What? It's a masterpiece. Mm. Well, no, Inside Out is a legitimate masterpiece, and it does so much more with that idea of these person, the personifications of these emotions than Herman's Head ever did. And is... Why is that funny? I'm serious.
No, I believe you. It's funny. I don't think anyone has tried to make the argument that Herman's Head has somehow stolen Inside Out's thunder before.
I'm making it right now.
All right, go for it.
I have spoken to people who dismissed this movie for that reason.
That's
totally
insane.
That they were like, oh, it's just, they've just used Herman. Like when the first trailers came out, which admittedly the trailers for this movie weren't that
great.
They
were not good, no.
They were not sort of like, oh, I've got to go see that movie kind of. They didn't really reach out and grab you. And when that happened, I saw some people kind of, oh, I don't know. It looks a lot, it's like, isn't this basically Herman's Head? I heard that from a couple of people. And the premise is, but they go so much further with it and invest all these great ideas. And like the basic premise, yes, is Herman's Head, but it goes so much further than that in creating this sort of world. The world building here is second to none. Pixar is really just, they are the best at just all the little touches that are just so amazing.
Yeah. And it's also like a kind of giant seeming story about basically a little girl who's sad when she has to move and misses her friends.
Yes.
Like it is the actual kind of ground that is covered in this movie is so kind of intimate and small, and it seems so huge because that's how it feels when you're 11 and these things happen to you. It's a really good movie. And also one of the few movies this summer that you'll see that is not part of a franchise or a sequel or
very
a
true
reboot. So I always feel like those deserve a little extra
support. Original filmmaking.
Yes,
especially
exactly.
Especially one as good as this one is. So yeah, it is awesome. Be sure to see it. Don't be swayed. Don't go, oh, I don't know if I feel like, a cry. You want the cry. Trust me. You want it.
The cry is good.
The cry is good. Embrace the cry. Yes, it is. It is like literally cathartic, like in the classic sense of the word cathartic. This is exactly what Inside Out gives you. Embrace it. It is great. So Inside Out, we recommend it. All right. So that was, what was the name of that segment again, Allison? singer Wilmer Squeak's High School New Release Roundup. I'm just going to start saying it as a jumble of words. And now it's time for Behind the Eight Ball, where we run down three new releases on streaming. We give you two listener recommendations, and we also choose one film blindly by number from each other's my lists. Allison, would you like to go first?
I would love to go first. Thank you, Matthew.
All right. Why don't you go first then and give us three new releases on streaming?
Okay. First up is available on Amazon Prime as well as Netflix. It is A Most Wanted Man, one of the late and much missed Philip Seymour Hoffman's final performances in a John le Carré adaptation directed by Anton Corbijn that for some reason just kind of came and went in theaters without that much attention. I really enjoyed this movie, though it's certainly not a happy story. Hoffman plays German intelligence agent Günter Bachmann, who is trying to prove that a prominent Muslim philanthropist is channeling some of his funds to Al-Qaeda. And it's a very Le Carré kind of espionage thriller. There's no glamour. It's filled with moral gray areas. And Hoffman is just fantastic. And it has a very strong cast as well that includes Rachel McAdams, Willem Dafoe, and Robin Wright. And it's one that I think, you know, if you didn't have a chance to see it in theaters, and it didn't get like a huge release, then I would say definitely you should stream it. It's pretty solid. Also new to Netflix is Point and Shoot, which is from Marshall Curry, the two-time Oscar nominee for Street Fight and If a Tree Falls, A Story of the Earth Liberation Front. Curry directed Point and Shoot, but it's just as much the creation of its subject, Matthew Van Dyke, who is a Baltimore man and who shot most of the footage himself. He set out on a road trip across North America and into the Middle East, sort of to kind of prove himself as a man. And he ends up fighting in the Libyan Civil War. And this movie is filled with some incredible and some very intense footage, but it is also just a fascinating portrait of a man kind of trying to find himself and also to kind of forcefully shape himself into something he is not. That is Point and Shoot, and it is now streaming on Netflix. And finally, I don't think I can ever say that I would recommend this movie, but I feel like it should be pointed out. It's as Matt, as you were saying earlier,
attention must be paid.
Yes, attention must be paid to The Cobbler, which is now streaming on Netflix. A much maligned movie that managed to unite
rightfully maligned
to unite journalists in loathing and rage at the Toronto Film Festival, where
bringing people together in hate.
It did, yes. And directed by Thomas McCarthy, who is the filmmaker and the actor turned filmmaker who directed The Station Agent, The Visitor, and Win Win. He co-wrote Up. He has like had an incredible run of movies.
Talented guy.
That has then come down to this movie,
yeah,
which stars Adam Sandler as, yep, Max Simkin, yep, who is one of a long line of Lower East Side cobblers, and a man who discovers that with the help of a magical shoe stitcher in his basement, he develops the powers to transform into other people just by putting on their shoes.
Yep.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's a confounding movie. It is not good.
Baffling.
It is. And I think the thing that is really difficult about it is that you have this filmmaker who
is racism.
Known...
Oh, sorry. Go ahead.
Well, yes. You have this filmmaker who is known for making these movies that are kind of complex and intimate and humane portraits,
yes,
of people who are often dismissed or kind,
yes,
of stereotyped.
Outsiders.
Right. And then he makes a movie literally based on the concept that to know someone, you have to walk a mile in their shoes.
True.
And it's just filled with terrible stereotypes, terrible racist stereotypes, mm-hmm, a stereotype involving either a trans woman or a cross-dresser who is just treated like terribly. It's kind of shocking, especially coming from him.
Yes, right. You would say from Adam Sandler, that doesn't seem that shocking. But
right,
coming from Thomas McCarthy,
it's unbelievable.
Baffling.
Yes. And then also we have to mention the ending of this movie, which is just something else. It really, I wrote about it for BuzzFeed because it is in many ways the most remarkable part of the movie and the most insane part of the movie.
Yeah.
And
we can't spoil it.
I can't. No,
because
absolutely not.
People who suffer through this movie deserve the shock of the insanity,
yes,
as a sort of reward for enduring it. And I actually would recommend is a tough word, Allison, but I would say it's worth paying attention. Attention must be paid because it is so crazy. It's not a movie that's so bad it's good.
No, it's not. It's bad. But
it is bad. It's so bad it's bad.
Yes.
But it's so bad that it's like kind of mesmerizing and shocking. Because like you said, it is just hard to believe that something this horrible can exist and be released on a large scale with an amazing cast.
Yeah, the cast is really
good. And talented filmmakers.
Yeah.
Like it's unusual and it's so rare that people this good could make something this bad.
Anyway, it's certainly not going to hurt Adam Sandler's career. I hope that it does not hurt Thomas McCarthy's career, because I would love to see another movie from him.
That's true.
Not this movie.
Hopefully.
But that is The Cobbler, and it is streaming on Netflix.
All right. How about two listener recommendations?
Okay. Well, first up, we have one from Jill, or actually three from Jill, who writes, "This weekend, I watched three showbiz documentaries on Netflix. The first one is Supermensch, The Legend of Shep Gordon, directed by Mike Myers, an engaging story of the lovable, generous, and charismatic talent manager of Alice Cooper and a bunch of other stars. I would totally go to one of his dinner parties. The second is Broadway Idiot, the story of turning Green Day's album American Idiot into a musical and then bringing it to Broadway. I was completely caught up in the energy and excitement of the music, their endeavor, and the Billy Joe Armstrongness of it all. And finally, Fame High follows several gifted students at the LA County High School for the Arts along their predictably crafted story arcs. I was captivated and dragged along with these kids through the perils of big dreams, problematic parents, and the predictable pitfalls of youth. Predictable is the key word. I recommend it if you're a sucker for these stories, which I am." Thank you, Jill, for those recommendations. And then we get a short one from Travis English on Twitter, who writes, "Zombievers. Kids, Cabin in the Woods, and Zombie Beavers." And really, what more do you need? That is streaming on Netflix as well.
All right. And one film from my list.
You mean number 21, which is Summer of Blood, a horror comedy vampire film that is directed by and stars Onur Turkel, who wrote his own description for IMDb. Eric Sparrow is one of the lucky ones. He's got a good job. He's in a stable relationship. He lives in one of the greatest cities in the world. Does he deserve it? Probably not. He's not too bright, not too attractive, not at all ambitious. He's chubby and always complaining. And when his girlfriend Jody proposes to him, he doesn't even have the good sense to accept her offer. He'll never find a woman like this again. Instead, Eric bumbles his way around the issue, offering one excuse after another for not getting married. And when Jody dumps him and starts seeing an old flame from college, Eric tries to win her back. When he fails, his life starts falling apart. His job grows more unfulfilling. And then one night, Eric meets an enigmatic stranger named Gavin, who asks him, "Do you want to die?" And he shrugs and says, "I do." Everything goes pitch black, and when Eric wakes up from the darkness, he finds himself changed forever. He's stronger, more confident. He's dating as a cinch. He's a Lothario, a sexual dynamo. He quits his job. Finally, he's free and unshackled with not a care in the world, except for one little thing, the excruciating stomach pains. There's only one remedy for that: blood. And, you know, I've heard this film described by various people as kind of a vampire movie meets Woody Allen, which is intriguing enough for me that I wanted to check it out. It's just a little indie, but I'm very curious about it. So that is Summer of Blood. It is on my list. All right, Matt, are you ready?
Yes.
All right. Three new releases.
All right. First up, a movie without which there might not be a film spotting, and therefore maybe not a film spotting SVU. It's High Fidelity from Stephen Frears, the director of Dirty Pretty Things. This is a very different movie than that one. It is a funny and insightful romantic comedy starring John Cusack as Chicago record store owner Rob Gordon, who spends his life obsessively curating and debating his musical collection and tastes with his co-workers as he's trying to get over this recent breakup with his girlfriend Laura, played by Ibn Ajeli. From High Fidelity, that was where Film Spotting got the whole concept of top five lists, which they've now done for 10 years. And I know as a fan just of the movie that it was a big inspiration on me. It's a great film. I haven't seen it in a couple years, but I've seen it many, many, many, many times. So it's always a good time to watch High Fidelity. So that's new on Netflix. Next up, season 3 of Orange is the New Black, which is also new on Netflix. We discussed each of the first two seasons of the show on Film Spotting SVU. You can hear our conversation on season 1 on SVU episode number 40 and the one on season 2 on SVU number 62. The series continues with much of the same cast, one of the largest and deepest in all of television, I would say. Allison, my wife and I, we're currently 3 episodes into the season so far. We are enjoying it just as much as ever. Have you watched it yet?
I finished it.
You binged the whole thing.
I did. And I was fairly restrained about it. My coworker actually watched the whole thing in one night.
That's insanity.
I know. It's terrifying. But
are they okay?
Maybe.
Madness! Madness!
Just imagining someone running through the halls of BuzzFeed.
Yes,
totally insane.
I thought it was just as good. It was, you know, I
good to hear.
Started off slightly slower, maybe, but I think just ended so strong and is always like just such a pleasure to watch.
All right. Well, 3 episodes in, I don't feel like it's slow. So that's good. I'm glad to hear that apparently it's going to get even more awesome as it goes on. So Orange is the New Black season 3 on Netflix. And finally, Troll 2, available now on Amazon Prime. It's a legendary bad movie from 1990, which does not feature any trolls and is in no way a sequel to the original movie called Troll. It was made by an Italian filmmaker who did not speak any English, basically, and had great difficulty communicating with his American crew, and it shows. It is a true and lovable disaster. It's gotten its own riff tracks. It was the subject of a documentary called Best Worst Movie, directed by Michael Stevenson, who is actually one of the stars of Troll 2. And it's just a very fun movie. Unlike The Cobbler, which is just so bad it's bad, this is a really classic so bad it's good movie. It is a very, very entertaining disaster. If you're in the mood for that, that's going to get the job done for you. That is Troll 2 on Amazon Prime.
All right, 2 listener recommendations.
First up, we've got one from Bibsy in Manchester, UK, who writes, "This is a streaming suggestion and a demand that it be talked about on the show. I am really not one for hyperbole, but Sense8 is the all in caps, the best TV of the year thus far. Netflix and the Wachowskis hit it out of the park. A group of people around the world are suddenly linked mentally and must find a way to survive being hunted by those who see them as a threat to the world's order. This story is a lot to take in the first episode, and it may seem a bit hard keeping up with it, but by episode 2, I was intrigued, and by episode 3, I was in full-on binge mode," which, as we've already established, sounds like this. 8 different storylines interweaved to perfection. I was on board for everyone's arc, and they all get one. It's a great ensemble. It's intellectual sci-fi. There's car chases, kick-ass fight scenes, hot, hot, hot sex scenes." 3 hots in the email there. Hot, hot, hot sex scenes with equal opportunity, full frontal, great comedy, compelling drama, and it's all beautifully filmed. I just want more. Watch it, then watch it again. Not because it's complicated. You will just want to. Love the podcast. Always will. From Bibsy in Manchester, UK. Allison, have you watched Sense8 yet?
I haven't seen any of it.
Okay.
But I will say, I was one of the few people who liked Jupiter Ascending.
That's a brave thing to admit in public. You know this is being recorded, right?
I see the light. I see the light on. I'm not afraid. Come at me.
All right. Fine. All right. I wasn't a fan of Jupiter Ascending, but I was a big fan of Cloud Atlas. And I watched the first episode. I felt, like Bibsy was saying, kind of a little slow to get going in the beginning. But it's just a matter of time. It's not that I wasn't interested to see the second episode. Just been a little busy. Orange is the New Black coming out 1 week later and wanting to get into that. It's just, it's tough having
Netflix's
to make time.
Netflix's schedule has been nuts this year.
Yeah. So, we may have more to say about Sense8 in just a minute or two. Our other recommendation this week comes from Simon. Simon writes, "Hi, guys. I would like to put forward the stunning documentary Antarctica, A Year on Ice, which I just saw is now on Netflix. The film tells the story of the people who live on Antarctica supporting the scientist. It took 10 years to make, with the director using custom rigs to produce some truly beautiful imagery. And the use of time-lapse photography is particularly great. The stories it tells are so fascinating, and these really are normal people like us living in an extraordinary environment, and the film gives us insight into their lives. I cannot recommend this film enough, and I hope you give it a shout out on the show. Thanks for everything. Kind regards, Simon," and there you go. Consider Antarctica, A Year on Ice, shouted out on the show. It is available now on Netflix.
All right, one from your My List.
You gave me number 12, and this time that is Bird People, the film by Pascal Ferran. Played at Cannes, played at Toronto, got some positive reviews. I haven't had a chance to see it. I know that it It's got some sort of twist or something that you don't want to have spoiled, so I've kind of avoided reading too much about it, but I will give you the plot description from Netflix. In a Paris airport hotel, a Silicon Valley engineer in the midst of a midlife crisis has a chance meeting with a maid that changes both their lives and has Josh Charles, I believe, is the star of the film.
Yes, he is.
And I could have watched it this week now that we are talking about it. Airport hotel.
It's totally set in the hotel, yeah.
I totally blew it. Could have watched it, and I missed my chance. But eventually, I will get around to it. That is Bird People. That is available on Netflix. Allison, is listener's choice option time. And we've got three excellent options. Intriguing options. And let's get to the first one right now. It is a television show called Sense8. Because Bibsy demanded it, Allison.
Yeah, let it never be said that we don't immediately give in to demands.
That's right. So Bibsy can vote for this one, but only once. Remember, I'll be watching you, Bibsy. One vote. You can encourage others to vote, but please restrain yourself. Let's keep it honest and fair on here. But yeah, it's the new series from the Wachowskis. I don't think I can recommend it any better than Bibsy already did. We've talked about it enough. Sense8, season one. And I'm sure there'll be plenty to discuss, too, with the Wachowskis, with what they're up to, with everything the show is about. That's option one, Sense8, season one, available on Netflix.
All right. Option two is another television show. It is one that has already aired in the UK on Channel 4, but is available in the US exclusively on Amazon Prime. It is Catastrophe, a British comedy starring Sharon Horgan and Rob Delaney of Twitter, the comedian who has kind of made a name for himself on Twitter and then kind of found fame and apparent, well, I haven't done a fortune, but fame off of it so far. And they play two people who get together. They have a brief affair while he's in the UK on business. And then she finds out she's pregnant and kind of calls him up and asks if he wants to make a go of it. And the TV show also stars Carrie Fisher, Ashley Jensen, and Mark Bonner, and has gotten some really good reviews. And a lot of people pointing out that it's kind of the rare grown-up romantic comedy, the kind of movie that actually tries to deal with what it's like to, you know, get pregnant first and then try and build a relationship. And so it's relatively short. Also, it's a UK season, so I think it's only maybe 6 episodes.
Yep.
But I think it's also already gotten renewed for a second season. And, you know, lots to talk about there. I think maybe, you know, Twitter has something to do with like new stars coming off of the internet.
Yes.
Or maybe about like the ways in which television and indies are holding up the romantic comedy now that Hollywood has basically let it go. So those are potential things we could talk about there for Catastrophe, which is streaming on Amazon Prime.
Okay. And option number three is not a television series. It is a film. It is called Life of Crime, and it is streaming now on Netflix. It's a 2014 film directed by Daniel Schechter. And it's got an amazing cast: Jennifer Aniston, Isla Fisher, Will Forte, Tim Robbins, and John Hawks and Mos Def playing Louis Scarra and Ordell Robbie. And if those character names sound familiar, that's because those are the Robert De Niro and Sam Jackson characters from Jackie Brown. Before they appeared in Rum Punch, which is the novel Quentin Tarantino adapted for Jackie Brown, they appeared in Elmore Leonard's The Switch, which is the source novel for Life of Crime. I'll read you the plot description. Two common criminals get more than they bargained for after kidnapping the wife of a corrupt real estate developer who shows no interest in paying the $1 million ransom for her safe return. And I actually think years ago, I read this novel. I don't remember it all that well, but, you know, I love Elmore Leonard. We could talk about Elmore Leonard. There's a lot of things we could do with this one. And it's just a movie I've been curious to see. You know, I do like Elmore Leonard novels, and I like a lot of the adaptations, too. And this movie played at Toronto.
And it has an amazing cast.
Has a great cast and generally got pretty positive reviews. And I've talked to a few people who said, oh, yeah, I liked it. It's pretty good. But it just kind of vanished. And so it would be worth, I think, you know, attention maybe must not be paid, but it'd be nice if it'd be nice for some attention to be paid to Life of Crime, which is available now on Netflix.
All right. Well, it's an interesting trio. Which of these movies / TV shows should we review on the next episode of Film Spotting Streaming Video Unit? I will say I'm genuinely curious. I have no idea which one's going to win. Usually I have a suspicion. Not in this case. You can send your pick to SVU at filmspottingsvu.com, or you can enter in the poll once, please, on the right-hand side of the page at filmspottingsvu.com. Your vote must be received by Monday, June 29th at noon. And after that, we'll announce the winner on Twitter at our Twitter account, which is at filmspottingsvu. And you'll have all that week to watch the film and then join us for our conversation on next week's episode, which will be on Tuesday, July 7th.
Filmspotting SVU is also where you can find our show archive, as well as a list of direct links to all the movies we discuss on the show. The Filmspotting SVU remix theme song is by Vince Vandal. You can listen to more of Vince's work at vincevandal.com. We will be back in 2 weeks with more movie recommendations and the movie or TV review you pick. But in the meantime, be sure to follow us on Twitter at Allison Wilmore, at Matt Singer, and follow the show at Filmspotting SVU. That's where we announce the winner of each show's listener's choice and where we share lots more streaming suggestions from us and from you guys, the SVU listeners. Don't forget to send us your recommendations over email. SVU at filmspottingsvu.com is the email address. We love to hear from you. Send us your feedback. Send us your recommendations. Whatever you want to send us, we would love to hear it. And also, don't forget to give us some recommendations on iTunes. Give us 5 stars. Leave us a positive review. It really helps us reach new listeners, and we really appreciate when you do it. For Filmspotting SVU, I'm Matt Singer.
And I'm Allison Wilmore. Thanks for listening.